Welcome to The Choice. This is Kurt Doolittle, and this is episode one. Now, why did I start The Choice? Well, like many of you, I watched the evolution of the intellectual dark web, its initial success, its reaching its limits, and its eventual stagnation and failure, although that failure appears to be due to one person's illness. I took this limit that it reached as evidence that the group wasn't really sufficient for the task, in no small part because there was only one token ethnic European, and among them, the group, there weren't any men of adversarial achievement. In other words, they weren't responsible for competition where they had to manage many other people, in particular in industry, government, or the military. They're basically academics with political commentators, and one of the academics has been working in the financial sectors. So I didn't think the group was sufficient for the task because they didn't have the experience. Now, that group couldn't or wouldn't address deep questions either, and it would generally resort to gossiping and complaining. And, you know, I thought maybe perhaps this gossiping and complaining was because the audience, or they felt the audience, wouldn't be able to work with deep content deep enough, and that they were sort of working with the market they had. But the problem with the strategy they're using is that at very best, they were slowing the natural progress of our civilization into managed decline. They weren't actually working to alter it. All they were doing was explaining to people how it was being managed and declined without offering any solutions to correcting this managed decline. Well, of course, this fall, Eric Weinstein started his podcast, The Portal, saying that he's discovered that there's enough demand for deep content that it's worth trying to see if you can put a podcast out on that sort of spectrum. And I felt that given there's quite a bit of overlap between my work and the topics that interest Eric, his take on geometry and my take on geometry in a science are very similar, and my take on geometry and law is even more interesting, perhaps. So I felt that that was good, that Eric's concern about the malincentives of the economy, of the academy, are terrible, really. I don't think Eric's added anything that wasn't stated by Thomas Sowell quite a long time ago, but the fact that Eric has specific cases of himself and his brother, and I have the case of myself, it wouldn't be possible to put a dissertation committee together for my work either, that was quite a bit of an overlap. Peter Thiel are also very interested in economics, and there's some problems in economics. None of these people deal too much with politics and law, and maybe not even social science, and that's sort of my area. So I thought there was enough overlap that, well, if Eric can put out a sophisticated podcast, then I'll try to do the same. I've had a lot of people ask me to put out more content, and my work has been, until recently, so burdensome that I haven't felt it was time. But at this, given that we are in this particular moment, I thought I would join the crowd. The crowd certainly is demonstrating some demand right now. So under the presumption that the market for depth exists, I'm going to run an experiment. But rather than talk about complaints, criticism, and appeals to reasonableness, or engage in what I consider shallow moralizing that doesn't do anything to change the circumstance, if best it helps us understand it, we talk about the causes of this condition and the solutions. And rather than avoid the great conflicts and taboos that they avoid so artfully, that I would actually answer them. Because while we can all feel sentimental agreement with complaints, and as an audience, it's nice to engage with speakers who reflect our feelings, emotions, and educate us a little bit, you get a very different circumstance when you start talking about what solutions would be put together. Solutions are more criticizable than complaints, and those solutions help us envision what costs we ourselves would have to pay in order to bring about. So this creates an intellectually honest discourse, and I just feel like gossiping, rallying, shaming, and shallow moralizing doesn't really do anything except entertain the audience, make the audience feel like they have a fellow priest that appreciates them, but actually does nothing to change the circumstance. Well, what drawbacks are there to deep causality and honest, if even taboo, causality and those solutions? Well, the internet's been helpful in bypassing this aging institutional media, this archaic artifact of the post-war era, the engine of propaganda that was turned from rallying the people in support of the wars and in support of transition to, in the mid-century, last century, turned to undermining the people and their strategy. So that aging media is falling apart, and the economics of that media prevents them from adapting. And that means that the only place to go today is people on the internet, where you can get long-form discussion, not broken into 7-minute segments that can't rely on any depth. That said, we have pretty solid data, though, about what people will watch on the internet and what they won't. First, they tend to watch people they like, regardless of the quality of their thoughts. You know, they don't watch the best thoughts, regardless of who speaks them, or at least most people don't. Secondly, they watch provides them with novelty that, in turn, provides them and more opportunity for novelty. And third, they watch what confirms their biases rather than what would change them. So we want education in confirming our biases so that we can have more novelty that confirms our biases. This tends to be self-reinforcing. But what it doesn't, that means is it's largely escapism. So I'm sort of faced with a set of challenges that will limit the audience for the choice. First, I don't have any idea whether I'm likable or not. Most public intellectuals share low trait agreement. We're more disagreeable, meaning that we don't feel anywhere near the need to agree or develop consensus with others that average people do. We're more comfortable speaking those painful truths than others, whether they're painful. I don't know if it's truths or not, but we're more comfortable speaking our minds than others are. And so while people seem to find me kind of charming in person, I guess, my public work, they know, certainly don't online. And this low need for agreement and the great desire for truth, regardless of cost, limits my likability. So that is, unless you're one of the people like me who prefers truth before face, regardless of cost. Second, while I'm trying to expose you to novelties, quite a few of them really, and while that novel understanding will give you a far deeper understanding of the world we live in than really almost anything else you can learn at present, and I know that sounds ridiculous, but it turns out to be true, what I'm doing isn't escapist in the least. It tends to be kind of wordy and a bit on the complicated side, unless you've at least studied some basic law, science, economics, and programming, so you know what these different terms mean. It's unfortunately that the academy is isolated by discipline and that you don't generally get to learn at least the first year of each major discipline, so that you can understand that there are a very consistent set of patterns, regardless of discipline, and that what I tend to do is speak in that pattern rather than any individual discipline. So it's quite wordy, and it's somewhat of work to do it, but there's no other way to get people there because our academic structure tends to favor rewarding specialization. Third, it's nice to listen to complaints, and when we listen to complaints, we can say, yeah, 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 but what we really mean is, we can't wait till other people do this for us. And it's a lot harder work to say, we're going to learn something, we're going to learn solutions that are criticizable, solutions that require us to pay costs, and we can envision those costs, and we have to change, and moreover, that we're some of the people that may have to bring about that change. That's a very different thing for people. So it's not really just pure entertainment and escapism. This is more like planning or working together to produce a solution and end. So working about solutions may not be as fun or entertaining as listening to complaints, criticism, and gossip. Fourth, no matter who you are, somewhere between immediately and eventually, I'm going to say something that offends you and your existing biases. In our civilization, which for reasons I'll explain, we have a bunch of grammars or systems of logic that we depend on different things, the most obvious being theology, philosophy, moral normative discussion, law, science, and mathematics. So between theology, philosophy, moral norms, law, and the sciences, you know, you have a bunch of grammars we all talk about, and each of us jealously guards our investment in the explanatory power of that grammar. So I'm going to almost always say something that alienates someone at some point in their grammar because their frame or their investment in the world is predicated on some set of ideas, and I'm going to eventually falsify some of those ideas, and it's going to be something you don't like. But hopefully, hopefully this kind of open honesty, despite these four objections, will help people from around the political, moral, and moral compass overlook what offends them and maybe feel that it might be worth investing in the effort and tolerate the fact that these novelties are a bit costly to learn. And regardless of my likability or not, hopefully, I'm just saying that it sounds like it's overwhelming, but hopefully we'll be able to work together to do something good for all of us. Well, what's the context? You know, to put this some context around what I'm saying, we used a windfall, in other words, the great returns on the legal, financial, economic, scientific, industrial, technological, and medical revolutions. And those were huge revolutions that drastically changed mankind, and there's no comparison to it in history. And then the Europeans took this, and whether we did a good job or not, forcibly distributed those revolutions around the world. And when we did that, we ran a number of experiments both around the world and domestically with our newfound agency and wealth. And some of those ideas turned out to be good and some not so good and some were catastrophic. In most cases, we felt liberated from the natural constraints. Some of those experiments did succeed. They were generally the material ones that I mentioned in the sciences. Some of those experiments failed. They were the economic and political experiments we have run. We found out that it takes quite a bit of luck, of circumstance to make a democracy work. And it turns out that democracies are very good at some things and they're very bad at others. China's certainly demonstrating what they're better at, and Islam is demonstrating what it's better at. Whether you think any of these things is particularly good is a different question. But some of those experiments clearly succeeded and failed. Some of our experiments were actually catastrophic, and they were in what was not solved by the scientific revolution, which was psychology, sociology, education, and finance. These things tended to be relatively catastrophic. One of the things I'll explain to you, if you follow me long enough, is why those failures occurred. But the culmination of these errors is produced a restoration of a conflict we thought we'd settled a long time ago by creating institutions in every mix of urban and agrarian civilization. And that is the difference in strategy between three competing instincts. We evolved to have a division of reproductive labor, but along with that, we got divisions of other kinds of labor. And with that, we developed divisions in instincts. And these competing instincts tend to be roughly categorized around the three personality clusters of the female egalitarian favoring consumption and reproduction, the ascendant male favoring production as a means of gaining advantage and status, and the established male hierarchical favoring capitalizing, saving, and preservation of the tribe. We call these the left, libertarian, and right, but they are just evolution's distribution of labor, giving our reproductive interests in consumption, production, and capitalization. We had, across Western civilization, assumed what I consider a naive optimism of the Enlightenment, and later under the false promises of French Revolution and the subsequent Marxist, neo-Marxist, postmodernist, and feminist counter-revolutions against the Enlightenment, that if granted equal opportunity under our new found material wealth, that our interests would converge in sort of some uniform, egalitarian, happy herd, like so many dehorned and belled female bovines. But instead, we discovered that the more luxury we have to pursue our preferences, the more we pursue the influences of our genetic interests. This divergence is more evident in the most egalitarian societies. We diverge whenever possible to fulfill our instincts. So in response, having discovered this, some of us have either ignored it and are continuing on our strategies, or some of us are counter-reacting against Enlightenment optimism, war-era fall, and the post-war undermining of our civilization. Some of us have chosen different strategies, although choose is a rough term. Some of us have So in response, having discovered this, some of us chose to restore the Middle Eastern world's group strategy. Each civilization has one. It's fairly easy to articulate them. One of the things I cover is the foundations of every group's strategy. And their strategy is equality in numbers and tribalism and familism, and try to keep everyone from getting ahead and keep all capital in the family and resist all capital expansion outside the family. This strategy is good for the family in itself, but it comes at the cost of development of institutions, development of corporations of any scale that produce multiples of return, development of bureaucracies and polities. It instead tends to produce corruption over the long term, which we can see in the way Middle Eastern countries fight wars, the difficulty they have with bureaucracies and corruption, difficulty they have with making corporations of any size. But this does, however, keep the bottom happy. Some of us choose to attempt the old world's communal strategy in search of equality in numbers. We can limit our differences at the cost of stagnation and decline. This is more of the traditional democratic socialist continental European strategy of limiting our differences at the cost of stagnation and decline. This strategy promises to drag us all upward, but it can't without windfalls. And if you look what happened to Europe's demographic, cultural, institutional capital over the past 70 years, you can see what's happening is that they have used all this consumption at the cost of reproduction, and their failure to reproduce has destroyed their civilization. So, in other words, they've engaged in an indirect form of hyperconsumption. Some of us want to continue the Eastern or Old World total family strategy of just suppressing disharmony. This is where we get face before truth. We don't state the truth. We try to preserve harmony and pretend there isn't anything wrong. This is a controlled imperial development, and it goes on independent of the rest of the world's behavior. It's a very long-term strategy. The Chinese have mastered it exceptionally, and combined with their military strategy of delay and deceive until the other side has no choice. It's one of the most successful strategies in history, but it requires you maintain a fortress against invasion of all kinds, including humans, cultural, ideological, religious, and military. Some of us choose to continue the Western civilizations group strategy of continuous rapid evolution. We limit our numbers, we delay reproduction, we make high investment in families that invest in the commons themselves. We make high investments in technology, and we do this at the cost of what the rest of the world rejects, which is the suppression of reproduction of those who are unproductive, and we take that savings and divert those proceeds to the production of high trust commons. This strategy doesn't factor us all upward. It's the most adaptive strategy in mankind, but it's also the most fragile because it's the most susceptible to invasion. Now, this Western historical strategy was to use small numbers, technology, and maneuver by a cast of professional warriors and a supporting cast of the universal militia, a militia of every-bodied man. And this produced an interesting behavior in that your equality is in your duty, in your rank, regardless of your status. So if the lowest man on the total pole does his duty on behalf of the commons in the military, then he's still a man of honor. And so this is an interesting way of producing equalitarian status despite hierarchical distribution of political power. In other words, you can, no matter who you are, you can have you can earn your status. This is why heroism is so important in Western civilization, and other civilizations can't understand it, but other civilizations can't produce our commons either. So once you have this universal militia, though, and everybody has their status, you're stuck with a very interesting problem of resolving disputes. And we did this by the natural law of tort, which is trespass, we call property in the long term, but it's really things that I've invested in. And natural law of tort depends on individual sovereignty. And then we use interpersonal reciprocity, which is what preserves that law of tort. We use adversarial competition before our jury, and we use markets and everything as a result. There's no other hierarchy other than the military, so the only thing that's left is markets. So we have a markets for association, cooperation, reproduction, production of commons and polities. And this, in turn, produces a market for elites. There's only three means of persuading human beings. It's force, remuneration, in other words, bribes or payment or trade, or fear of ostracization and undermining. So these three means of coercing people or forcing people turn out to be a mirror image of the female that fights by undermining and ostracization, the libertarian or ascendant male that tries to obtain status through trade, and the established or dominant male who preserves limits and capital by force. So we see that we have developed elites in all these things. We have developed martial elites, legal elites, and priestly elites. And so this continuous market, not only in every means of working together, but even among elites, is what makes Western civilization alien to other groups. Because even here at home, we seek to make monopolies. The faithful want a monopoly. The people like me want a legal monopoly. And the authoritarian people want a forced monopoly, because that's an expression of our genetic interests. The way we resolved this is we did use the law as the mediation between the majority masculine, the majority feminine, and then the weaker, frankly, legal and craftsman in between them. We treated and always have treated the law as an equivalent to a priestly occupation. So this is one of the secrets to the reason our law works in the West, why we have rule of law, is because it fundamentally, which is really easy to observe if you know any American constitutionalists, you know, traditional conservatives, is that the Constitution and the law are a negative version of the positive we find in Christianity. In other words, the law is a negative version, but it's also sacred, and Christianity is sacred, and that's the positive, almost feminine version. And Christians don't like it, I say that, but I have to make this contrast so that people see that these priesthoods compete. So we have these three sets of elites, and they reflect our genetic interests, they compete, and it is this continuous competition that doesn't allow anybody to obtain rents against the other. That's one of the sources of our success. So cumulatively, when we bring together all these markets from the associative, cooperative, productive, reproductive, commons, and polities, the production of markets for commons. And when we produce all these things, we've worked together in all these markets, and we have only the law to judge each other by in the negative, and only Christianity to judge each other by in the positive. The more pagan aspect of the military is a thing in itself, and it used to be very visible in our society. It's less visible now because the need for our military has changed dramatically, and the post-war effort to ostracize the military from political life was pretty successful, so it downplayed that part of our history. Anyway, I took a tangent there in order to put the West historical strategy in contrast, but we use these markets, and by the use of these markets, because those markets leave people out, people who can't survive in them, they were put in positions where they didn't reproduce. So we were able to drag the demographics of the population up over time. And so we self-domesticated each other, just like we had wheat, cattle, and horse. We just domesticated man from the slave, serf, freeman, citizen to sovereign, to the point where most of us are somewhere between freemen and sovereigns today, although I think most of us feel like tax serfs. This came at the suppression of the reproduction of that unproductive class. Unfortunately, what's happened in the Industrial Revolution is we've done two things. We have stopped breeding at the top. We've increased the breeding at the bottom. And where we didn't increase the breeding at the bottom, we've imported a very large bottom that cannot compete under this universal market strategy. And so that's what's driving the urban pressure for returning to the old world strategy of no one being left behind, because they are not able to compete in that that hierarchical market. There's more going on here that mostly has to do with economics and the fact that we were able to get away with a lot in the 20th that we're not going to be able to get away with in the future. But anyway, the idea I wanted to get across was the structure of this self-domestication of Western Indo-European, Bronze Age European, ancient Mediterranean, medieval continental, modern Atlantic, Age of Sail, and right up into the present Age of Flight, that we had kept the strategy relatively consistent over time, despite the change in our religious and philosophical content over that period. The underlying group strategy and its martial dependency remained the same because it had to. We have, for geographic reasons, there's no other way for Europeans to fight. So this strategy held again from the Pontic Steppes all the way to the French Revolution, which is where every bad idea begins in France. So the French Revolution comes about because France is the most politically backward country in Europe, and they destroy the aristocracy and they bring about this idealism. This migrates into what's Marxism and then the Bolshevik Revolution that destroys the Russian people and sets them back. And then those same people came to the Americas in the post-war period and during the 50s and 60s tried the same undermining on Americans that they had on the Russians, a less violent but similar undermining the French had done on the aristocracy. So despite the Byzantine conquest of Rome and the efforts of the church to politically usurp the martial aristocracy and governors over the centuries, this underlying group strategy still prevailed, and it has prevailed until fairly recently. Now, given that, all of these alternative strategies, in other words, the West is still there, plus the Eastern, plus the Middle Eastern, plus the continental social strategy, they're all currently competing for the power space that's being opened up by the collapse of Western civilization. So there's these people who want to preserve Western civilization, and people want to restore it to one of these more primitive group strategies. Now, that's the crisis that's going on. And of course, I'm going to come out here and say, well, you know, let's be real that the choices you all have were brought about by that Western civilizational strategy. And to some degree, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You either have the continuation of that strategy or you lose the benefits of it. And there are other people who will explain to you why we are rapidly losing the benefits of that civilization because of our failure to understand it. So, well, a lot of what I'm going to do, which I've started doing here, is over the course of these podcasts, explain to you a little bit more about our civilization, how it works. And by repetition, I hope to make this relatively complex set of levers seem to make sense to you. Now, how was this sort of collapse made possible? Well, it was possible because of a false promise. The post-war destruction of the West was made possible by a false promise of continuous growth. You know, in some degree, we had the combination of the Industrial Revolution freeing us from physical labor. We had the industrial production of household goods that made it possible for women to go to the workforce. We had eliminated the difficulty in obtaining information because of television, telephone, radio, and finally the internet. But what we mostly had was the invention of fiat currency, which is the ability to print money. Money today is a share. A dollar is a share in the United States economy. That's what is no different from a share in any other Fortune 500 company, except it's the world's most profitable company. And so that's what a share is. And so by continuously issuing new shares, diluting new shares, we're able to generate more wealth. Because we're able to do that, we're able to ensure your money being saved in banks, and we're able to lend more money to banks to be able to use as credit, thus creating even more money. That created a huge explosion then in the use of money to be able to persuade people to do other things. One of the things we've been able to persuade people to do is take certain kinds of risks. And those risks turn out to be, have some of them been extremely dangerous and some of them have not. I'll try to go into those in detail. The most important of those risks was the idea that we were now free not only from constraints on our consumption, constraints on our self-indulgence, constraints of the intergenerational production of children, constraints on traditional manners, ethics, and morals, and finally, constraints on the truth. The one that most of the post-war destruction civilization is built around is that we seem to get away from this idea that we're free from evolutionary pressure, and we're not. In some degree, the failure of the education system over the past 70 years, and this failure to reform especially, is due to the failure to recognize human differences. In other words, it's one of those examples of this parable of 17 lies. Education is predicated on one lie, that we aren't biologically different, we don't biologically mature at different rates, because we don't mature at different rates, we don't learn at different rates, we don't learn different things at different times in our lifetimes, and we aren't limited because of those differences in what we can learn and the speed at which we can learn them. And this has led to all sorts sorts of false promises in education, and this has rolled into the academy as a consequence, rolled into the economy, and rolled into politics as well. So you could see the post-war destruction of Western civilization as a denial of Darwin in an attempt to deny Western civilization, whose primary function was self-domestication, or Darwinism before we knew what it was. When the founders built the United States, they said they would, and these are my Puritan ancestors, they went out and recruited people who were of good character. If you go out and look for the initial recruiting documents and contracts for people that would be moved to the new territories, the new colonies, they were searching for successful farming families, successful entrepreneurial families, and they were looking for people who would succeed. They were trying to filter out people of bad character. If you look at how they taught the church would never be integrated in the states, would have no power. And you look at how the founders eliminated aristocracy, they were eliminating privilege. So what they were trying to do is produce a what we would think of as a Darwinian civilization, a majority middle class that was consisted only of people of merit. They wanted to leave the people who were unproductive or hedonistic, the people who were parasitic in the church, and the people who were parasitic in the aristocracy, they wanted to leave them behind. And that was the American experiment. Our Constitution is an enumeration of the rules necessary by which to persist this civilization. And our success is predicated on it. So the post-war destruction of Western civilization was made possible by a false promise of continuous growth. The traditional practitioners of Western civilization saw our industrial, technological, medical miracle as a windfall that would eventually dissipate, but the people who undermined Western civilization used the false promise of this freedom from natural laws to pretend there could be infinite growth. As such, there could be infinite growth in the human herd. And so when you talk to the different groups, this is one of the underlying questions. The left can't say what it really wants, which is to live at the expense of others, and the right can't really say what it really means, which is that we were successful because we domesticated human animals. We've always practiced eugenics. So the real conflict here is between this dysgenic feminine herd left and the eugenic masculine tribal right and the traditional libertarian productive Western middle class that's trying to maintain a balance between them. So as we've seen since the restoration of the world economy in the 70s, in other words, the collapse happened, the world fell apart. The world that wasn't victim of war was victim of the false promise of Marxism, socialism, feminism, postmodernism. And by the 1970s, the world had started to come back together, and our post-war advantage that everybody thought was the new norm quickly dissipated. And as we've seen, exacerbated by the restoration of Chinese and Indian workforces from their failed experiments with Indian socialism and Chinese communism, the windfall of the European and scientific revolutions, the windfall of the European expansion and trade, and the windfall of the post-war technological revolutions, and the windfall of the post-war period where we were the only people with a productive infrastructure left, all those windfalls are exhausted, and the future looks more increasingly like overpopulated super cities consisting of a very elite core ringed by ghettos and favelas. It looks far more like that than the Star Trek science fiction upper middle class majority that we envisioned only decades ago. So we're sort of faced with this competition of genetic interests between the sexes, classes, races, subraces, the secular and theological religions, the pseudosciences and sophistries. And these are all expressed as political and moral biases, and we're arguing them in theological, philosophical, ideological, and pseudoscientific and scientific terms. And then the wealth that eliminates the need to compromise between all those different factions, the institution of democracy, which liberates all those factions, and the increasing hostile relationship over the future that few of us are willing to sacrifice because we perceive our competitors as immoral, and by separate measures of our strategy, they are immoral. So the point here being that we just don't have any incentive to compromise with one another. They don't really have a need to compromise with one another. The only thing that's preventing us from pursuing our different interests is a rather unique demand that the empires, whether it's the American, the Canadian, the Australian, or the European project, whether these empires maintain contiguous and the ability to form three functions, pay for very expensive defense, finance very expansive debt, which eventually accumulates in crisis, and form trade blocks. Those are only three values of scale. But those three values of scale come at the cost of each of us wanting to express our genetic interests. And unfortunately, some of us want to continue doing what has been successful for Western civilization. Some of us want to regress to the continental versions, and some of us want to regress to the more primitive Middle Eastern version. Some of us want to take on the more authoritarian version that we see in China and Russia. We have these different ideas. The only thing that's preventing us is the institutional structure that we've inherited. So it's pretty obvious what we need to do. We need to look at and what had made Europe successful, which is many small, low-power distance, homogenous states, homogenous in interests, where they produce commons demanded by the needs and demographics of those populations. But we just need to share our ancestral group strategy, myths, traditions, institutions, and laws. Well, I'm not even sure we can share those that strategy, myths, traditions, and laws. Maybe all we can share is the law itself, because we're all different. We have lots of different needs, and we're wealthy enough. Despite the fact that our post-war wealth has gone by, it doesn't mean we aren't wealthy enough to pursue those different interests. So, and we differ by rate and depth of maturity, degree of sexual dimorphism, degree of neoteny, by the size of our underclasses. In other words, the middle of our distribution determines our norms, and the size of the underclass determines the middle of the distribution. If you look at East Asians and Westerners, we've tended to be pretty successful at eugenics, shifting of our curve to the right. Warmer climates have been less successful at shifting their distribution to the right. And so we have more advanced civilizations with better distributions and lower advanced civilizations with worse distributions. There's not really much that can be done for it, because productive economies and working together and institutions that support people work together, and the market for each other's productivity is limited by our demographic differences. We differ in truth before face or virtue and deceit. We differ in the use of science, wisdom literature, wisdom that's based on ancestor mythological, supernatural, supernormal, and authoritarian religions. We differ in the preference for empiricism, reasonableness, tradition, or superstition. We differ in preference for familism, tribalism, nationalism, or universalism. We differ in our mating preferences, family and marriage compositions. We differ by organization, hierarchies, markets, or equalities. We differ in organizations by individual, clan, tribe, nation, or universal allocations of property. We differ in ethical and moral differences. We differ in investments in the commons, investments in our clans, investments in individual consumption. And certainly, as I've tried to illustrate here, we differ in eugenic and dysgenic reproduction. So we birth, grow, we mature, evolve, adapt, innovate at different rates. And so we have different needs and we have different wants. The experiment with uniting our cultures has failed. Every single attempt at integration has failed. And our country is dying one city at a time from attempting to circumvent that failure. And we have decades and decades now of evidence that it doesn't ever work. The education system is littered with the evidence of, and the acknowledgement of, frankly, that integration doesn't work. Of course, I'm going to say that integration is cruel to people because we need to produce commons suitable to those people. You know, the Western presumption that we could create an aristocracy of everyone was as disastrous as the Jewish and Muslim presumption that we could create a universal underclass of everyone. And so the experiment's over. We failed to complete the colonial program of dragging humanity kicking and screaming out of ignorance, superstition, poverty, starvation, hard labor, child mortality, early death, suffering, disease, despotism, and frankly, the vicissitudes of a nature all but hostile to our lives. In the post-war period, we tried to create a middle-class world where trade was sufficient means of order. We tried to extend our utopian vision of an aristocracy of everyone, a middle class of everyone, where everyone was productive, a virtuous member of society, and that we had eliminated the parasites, whether they're upon the productive peoples, whether they were the underclasses, the aristocracy, or the priesthood. And so what's our choice? Well, what is our choice? Are the left, right, and status quo are competing of how to use this inflection point in time to recast America, the Anglosphere of Britain, America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, as well as to some degree Western, Central, Southern, Eastern, and Russian Europe in response to this current crisis, current election cycles, and the end of the post-war Pax Americana, and the near future inability of traditional Americans, English, and Canadians to win an election given overwhelming second and third order immigration, and the subsequent near future eradication of Western people and their civilization. An event which, if successful, will add Western civilization to the lost peoples of history, their cultures, arts, letters, institutions, and values, and that's the lost civilizations of North Africa, Egypt, the Levant, Byzantium, Greece, Rome, Persia, and Northwest Indian civilization. Now, the left won't willingly surrender, the right won't willingly surrender, and elected or unelected majority over either won't be tolerated by either. In other words, there's no means of having a legitimate government over either. The government, especially the deep state, will not willingly reform. I mean, we can see at the current moment that the current administration, whether you like it or not, is trying to collapse the American empire back to a domestic government, and the entire edifice out of self-interest is trying to preserve itself. So the government won't reform. The European Union won't reform. And the worst of all, the global financial network that really governs us all won't reform. In fact, they're going to resist it every potential opportunity possible, and they'll go to every possible means, ethical, unethical, visible, and obscure, to protect their positions. But no empire in history has ever been as fragile as America, and the West, as a consequence, is dependent militarily on America. So all civilizational collapses are the result of mass migrations, which we've had, the reorganization of political power, the seizures of opportunity to control new territory, markets, trade routes, and profit from the demographic change. And so I'd like to recommend a compromise solution that would satisfy all parties. Well, and satisfy doesn't mean please, it means satisfy. These are a set of constitutional amendments that provide all of us with most of what we want, if not everything that we want. We can peacefully return to the original intention of the American experiment as a cloning of the diverse European states and separate into, say, immigrant cities and European traditional territorial states, and devolve the federal government to the states, preserving the necessary functions of the military, treasury, insurer of last resort, and state negotiator of trade. And I've done most of the work to get us there. Of course, the other choice is that we can begin a conflict that we all know is right under the surface, a conflict that will escalate into politicide as we try to eliminate a spokesman for our enemies, and that will eventually escalate into ethnocide as we pursue our most precious interests. That will eventually escalate into genocide, and it will be the bloodiest house-to-house combination of revolutionary and civil war in human history. The consequences will be worse than the world wars. They'll be equal in scale to the Arab destruction of the ancient world or the Bronze Age collapse. Because not only here at home in the States, but the pent-up demand for civilizational expansion around the world that's been held in check by American military power is pensively seeking opportunities to seize given the worldwide return to normal. The people in democracies may not see the world returning to normal, but everyone else in the world sees the world returning to normal. As a collection of civilizations governed most primarily by their core states, all of us competing against each other as vast markets with very different group strategies, speaking different languages with different customs. And the only thing we share across each other is the necessity of reciprocity that limits our incentive to conduct warfare. This war would leave us here in America with a third of the population dead, every major urban center at least smoking rubble, economy with it, and a continent reduced 19th century life, if not dark ages, without a population that knows enough to rebuild it. And for those who are overly confident, they feel nice and secure in their island America. I don't know how easy it is to make that war happen. I don't have any knowledge of the current fragility of this nation, its infrastructure, how few people it takes to end all that, and the hatred of one another brewing on each end of the spectrum, or the passion for using violence against one another, nor how vigorously those people will fight for the opportunity to win. And those men who have intentionally been ostracized by the left by design to destroy that military tradition, that long tradition of Western civilization, which is the foundation of our civilization. They're angriest of all, and they're the largest army on Earth by more than an order of magnitude, and frankly, they're in both our police forces and our military as well. And the only reason they haven't acted is because, first, they haven't had the need to. Secondly, they haven't had a plan. and very shortly they're going to understand that they must. Every day the window of opportunity shifts over them. So what am I going to explain to you? Well, to enact a nonviolent change, in other words, to bring about something that's in our interest, moral people need a moral license to alter their governments, that is, and we certainly have one. I've tried to just explain it. But we need a solution structured as a set of demands. That's how to reorganize it. We need a plan of transition. And frankly, we need a threat of successful overthrow that's scarier than the change. My work, besides being a formal logic of social science, at its core is an improvement on a traditional European, Germanic, British, and American common law. As a technology of law, it's just as great an advancement over the written American Constitution as the American was over the unwritten British, and the unwritten British over the haphazard mixture of traditions of rule of law that came before it. Now, my work repairs most of the holes in the existing Constitution. I'm never going to imagine it's going to plug all of them, but it probably comes close. And it implements and uses a formal jurisprudence. I don't know if you know what that means, but think of it as a logic of deciding the law. Ending the debate over the four types of jurisprudence that create the conflict in our civilization today. Our Constitution doesn't specify that means of jurisprudence, and that's why judges basically, quote, make stuff up. So this would end the debate and fix the weaknesses in the law itself. It also does things like updates our rights under that law and the requirements within that body of law to end the great problems of our age and explains why those problems were possible. My work is to law as writing is to programming. It creates strictly constructed law from first principles closed to interpretation. But law alone is just one thing, and you have to use that law to create institutions of government because it's institutions of government that allow us to cooperate on the production of commons despite our differences. Democracy is very good for the resolution of differences in priority among people with similar interests. But once you have demand for commons with people with competing interests, the only solution is to separate and then to produce markets for the production of commons, where we can trade with one another on means, if not on identical ends. This is what markets do for us. They solve the problem of scale. So using that law, I hope to explain to you a set of options and to work with you and to produce that peaceful means of transition over the objections of those elites who would pay their price for their, let's be nice and say, abuse of our people, especially those in the state, financial, industrial, academy, and media sectors. They're not huge in number, but they've used the false promise of continued growth and freedom from laws of nature, natural law, and the laws of evolutionary necessity. And they've destroyed everything socialists, libertarians, and conservatives held dear. And they're going to fight at every opportunity because they know they're guilty. And they know the consequences of our prosecuting them for their guilt. Now, we can't make everyone happy. We can make most people other than the elites happy because it's the elites that will suffer the most as we perform the greatest restitution of power to the people in human history. So what's the purpose of this show, The Choice? I'd like to have us to have a Founding Fathers discussion for the next iteration of Western civilization, something we seem to do pretty regularly. We reform our Constitution and the system of laws with it. That's what's beautiful about rule of law, is you change the processes, you change the people, and you don't have to have bloody wars to do it, although it seems like we need to have a little bit of revolution every century or so to keep evolving because of the tendency of bureaucracies to entrench themselves in rent-seeking behaviors. Last time we had the Federalist Papers, and we did that on the printing press. This time we can have them once again in tiny bits and bytes, and we can do that without being disintermediated by the media as we were in the post-war era. And we can create not a sacrifice, but a renaissance, not a horror, but a flowering, and a better world than we leave behind. And that's because of our differences, not in spite of them. Otherwise, and I'll say this frankly, and I realize for those of you who aren't American, that it is our tradition and our law to be able to discuss revolution. Until you chamber the round and pull the trigger, talking about it is legal. but I feel we need to add a little edge if it's not coming clear in what I'm saying. Because not only are we going to have to come to some agreement, but if we don't, frankly, I'm just as happy as are my fellows to return to our most successful tradition, mount up and hoist the sail, raise the Jolly Roger, and carve our names into history as a new monument to the political hubris. After all, War of Conquest is the most profitable of entrepreneurial enterprises, and there is nothing more natural to man than hunting other men. So in closing, please follow John Mark and In Truth Victorious on YouTube if you want to understand our project in neurotypical terms. I am justifiably criticized for the technical nature of my work, but I find this is a little bit like saying, yes, calculus can't be true because it's hard. Well, formal operational logic of law is like calculus, it's hard. It doesn't mean it's false. Just the opposite. It means just as calculus provided us with greater explanatory power, just like the application of the calculus to economics provided us with greater explanatory power, and just like that same application to physics provided us with more explanatory power in the understanding the subatomic world, operational law will provide you with explanatory power in the metaphysical, psychological, and social sciences. Anyway, we call this project Strictly Constructed Natural Law, or the Natural Law of European Civilization, the Law of Sovereignty, or more colloquially among our in-group, the Propertarianism, which is really just a nod to libertarianism, or the Group Strategy of the European Peoples. This is Kurt Doolittle. Thank you for listening.